Financial institutions are failing and Congress is being asked to ride to the rescue. If that sounds familiar to some old-timers, it's because today's problems on Wall Street seem to be echoing savings and loan failures of the late 80s and early 90s. So is there anything we can learn from the causes, costs, and cleanup of the savings and loan crisis that might help us navigate today's problems? Well, we are joined now by investigative journalist David K. Johnston and associate editor of Barron's Magazine, Michael Santoli. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Weren't bad lending practices, especially for mortgages, the trigger for both the savings and loan crisis and our current financial meltdown?
Well, the savings loan crisis, Leonard, had two components to it. One was all sorts of bad lending practices, loans on buildings that were never going to get built, and very badly priced deals. But there was a second important point, and that was that Congress, when it then raised to $100,000 the guarantee on money, created an environment where people were doing what was called hot money. They were moving it wherever they could get the highest interest rate, and there were lots of outstanding mortgages at fixed rates. So the banks ended up paying out more than they were taking in, and the savings and loans did, and that was also a major factor.
So, and that's something that hasn't happened in this case.
This case involves not the interest rate arbitrage issue. This is a very complicated matter about the failure of regulation, and but it has at its core the subprime lending, where the loans were not held by the banks; they were sold off. So. People collected big fees up front and had no responsibility after that. And secondly, this $40 or $50 trillion market in credit default swaps, which works just fine so long as there's normal business failures, but as soon as you have a general meltdown, doesn't work at all.
But wasn't the savings and loan debacle also due to some degree to deregulation? They'd been around since the 1800s. And it was only after deregulation that we had this crisis.
Yes, and a little trademark line of mine, there is no such thing as deregulation. There is only new regulation. And this was new regulation that didn't work, just as what we've done with the banking industry didn't work. We knew how to have sound regulation, and unfortunately we have not learned the lessons of the past about that.
But isn't what we're seeing today, where deregulation allowed many large financial institutions to overextend themselves, just another version of that? In the end, I would have thought after things were not regulated strongly and we saw that there was a crisis, that there would have been a feeling that we had to do a little more regulation. Do we keep on forgetting the lessons of the past?
Well, we have a political culture that says this is a good thing, get rid of regulation. And let me draw you an analogy. You know, we had the financial community on Wall Street and others saying, hey, we're responsible. This is our money at risk and our clients' money, and we don't need government telling us what to do here. We're big boys. And so we took off all sorts of constraints and allowed this shadow financial system, and we reduced some areas of regulation. Well, you know, almost all drivers are responsible, and they follow the speed limit, and they're sober, and they stop at the stop sign. So what would happen if we decided to remove the stop signs, the stoplights, the speed limits, and repeal the drunk driving laws? You know what would happen. You need to have constraints not for the people who are responsible, but for the people who are irresponsible.
Michael, last
yes.
week, Tim Ryan, who was the director of the U.S. Treasury's Office of Thrift and Supervision during the savings and loan crisis, wrote in the Financial Times that even though the S&L crisis directly affected the deposits of millions of Americans, Congress did not act until August 1989, years after the first S&L failure and safely after an election. Well, we're seeing a strong push to pass a plan in Congress this week, even though it's unpopular with parts of the public. Why wasn't there a similar sense of urgency in 1989?
Well, one thing to keep in mind in terms of how it all came about that that the crisis finally was reconciled was the government ended up seizing one by one these failing institutions and owning them. So it wasn't so much that what we have now, where the entire system seems at risk, and therefore Congress feels compelled to act in some way. It was much more of a slow motion disaster then, and I'm not going to say that this time the authorities have been impressively proactive all along the way. They've been attempting to have certain measures that nurse the system along for a while. But I do think it's because the actual day-to-day routine functioning of the banking system seems to be at risk right now, and that's why you are seeing this sense of urgency.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask, are you surprised, either of you, that so little mention has been made of John McCain's troubles that followed the SNL crisis? Because he was included in the Keating Five. And other people have seen certain similarities between these two events. Michael, you want to tackle that, is that irrelevant?
I don't know that it's irrelevant. I do think that people are not needing to stretch back in memory to the previous financial disaster to find a thing to worry about. And I do think that
In presidential races, everybody's always going back and finding dirty laundry of some sort or another.
I think it just gets a pro forma mention in McCain's relationship with the financial system. It's slightly surprising. I do think that the fact that he sort of managed to rehabilitate his career after that might sort of give excuse to not pay so much attention to what happened back then in the 80s.
Leonard, let me suggest one other thing. What's far more relevant is who McCain's advisors are today. I mean, one of the principal pushers of the policies that got us in this trouble, the Enron debacle, a lot of other problems, is Phil Graham. And, well, officially, Phil Graham is no longer with the McCain campaign. He's right there. He's highly likely to be Treasury Secretary, and if he isn't, he will certainly have a big influence in the McCain administration. That's what I'm surprised there isn't a great deal more mention of.
One of the congressional responses to the savings and loan crisis of 1989 was the creation of the Resolution Trust Corporation, the RTC. What was its mission?
Mike? It was essentially charged with administering all of these failed institutions and all of their assets, and sort of in a orderly way attempting to sell them off and to sort of bring to a close the government's ownership of these things. So it was something that was a cleanup effort after most of the difficulties had passed, and it dragged on for some years. And I think the people who did administer it will try to suggest that the government actually made perhaps a small profit on it.
And Leonard, two things about that. What we were seeing happen then, and we're going to see happen here, is that effectively the nationalizing. If a foreign government did this, the news reports would be that the Venezuelans or the British or the Argentinians have nationalized these institutions. And remember that in the SNL cleanup, the government made some incredibly awful deals that allowed people who put up almost no money to become multi-billionaires. And to think that we will not, with the plan we're pursuing now, a plan that the more it's looked at is seen as maybe the only thing to do at the moment because they bungled this, but an awful plan, it's going to lead to a great deal of profiteering. In fact, the cover of Barron's this week, which is not about profiteering, but the cover is how to profit off the $700 billion bailout.
Michael?
It's not how to profit off of it. It's how profitable it is liable to be for the government, for the Treasury itself, simply because, and of course, there's many assumptions that have to go into that. But when you're a government, you borrow at 3-4%, and you're buying assets where even on the safer end of the spectrum are yielding 10-12%, and in theory, you're going to be buying them at a fairly good economic price just because the institutions are motivated to get them off their books. It does seem as if there's a reasonable expectation that if not making a big profit, that there's a big cushion in the 700. And I think that there's a general misunderstanding out there that there's somehow going to be $700 billion spent and gone to zero, as opposed to $700 billion where there's a cash cushion and hopefully there's actually going to be genuine investment value there of some quantity.
So, Mike, are you suggesting that we may very well get back all this money?
That's exactly what may happen. I mean,
and it may not happen, right?
Of course, but it's not zero. There's no way it's zero.
Well, it's possibly, and by the way, I stand corrected about my misunderstanding of how the headline read. But
You're at the airport, right, David?
That's right.
You could pick it up at a newsstand there.
I actually have it in my bag. I was doing it from memory. I should have pulled it out and looked at it. But the we might make a profit off of this, but, you know, this could also make it vastly worse. One of the things that isn't being discussed is what are the risks to the economy of borrowing $700 billion and we're already in debt to acquire assets whose value we really don't know. Will it, if it doesn't ease up liquidity and doesn't solve the problem of people who have money to put out not trusting they'll get it back from the counterparty, would it make things worse? There's been almost no discussion of that. So, yes, it might turn a profit. It might also just turn out to be the down payment on a much bigger expense.
In last night's debate, Senator Joe Biden spoke about what he thinks the criteria for the financial rescue plan currently before Congress should be. Let's play that clip.
Barack Obama laid out four basic criteria for any kind of rescue plan here. He first of all said there has to be oversight. We're not going to write any check to anybody unless there's oversight for the Secretary of Treasury. He secondly said you have to focus on homeowners and folks on Main Street. Thirdly, he said that if you have to treat the taxpayers like investors in this case. And lastly, what you have to do is make sure the CEOs don't benefit from this, because this could end up in the long run people making money off of this rescue plan.
Now, we were just talking about that. He was warning against CEOs profiting from this rescue plan. Is that a strong possibility?
Oh, I think you're absolutely going to see people profit off this, because the government is not going to do a good job as pricing in these matters. As people like Goldman Sachs and others in their business are masters at understanding the difference between price and value and exploiting that, and they're very, very good at it. They're the best at it. That's why they're so rich.
Well, I would say that, first of all, this is not the pricing of these assets is almost certainly not going to happen in Henry Paulson's office or in Washington, D.C., but we're going to contract most likely to asset management firms that are in this business to do so, and hopefully in a very transparent way. But I do, however, agree that, you know, some CEOs will inherently profit off this, if only because it could potentially save some institutions and make their stock prices go up. And absolutely, it could happen that way. I think that the direct thing you want to defend against is, you know, if a company is forced to be sold by by the government, that there's somehow just because of that transaction some big payday that the CEO gets, as if they had sold the company for a big profit.
But the government isn't buying the property under the current plan, are they? They're buying
assets. The bill empowers the Treasury Secretary to buy not just mortgages, but any asset that he believes will help improve the liquidity in the market. He is not required to pay the lowest possible price through auctions, and he's allowed to buy assets from whomever he deems appropriate, including foreign banks and foreign central banks.
My guests are investigative journalist David K. Johnson and associate editor of Barron's Magazine, Michael Santoli. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Did the creation of the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation, have a positive effect on stock prices when it was created? Mike?
I don't think just simply the creation of it. Again, I think you have to consider that it was a much more slow motion process then. It wasn't as if the entire market was hinging on will they do it, will it be passed. It was again much more of a salvage effort in my mind, as opposed to what this is at least being viewed as, which is some crucial make or break thing. And I agree that this may not be the thing that fully unclogs the system. But I feel as if that the Treasury and the Federal Reserve have kind of approached this whole thing, and perhaps nobody saw the magnitude of it at the beginning, but they've approached it in a manner that, the cardiologist says first try diet and exercise, then try Lipitor, and then go on from there until you get to the heart transplant and the bypass. So that's the way they've approached it, and I do think that's why it's seen as having much higher stakes in the short term.
Well, that 777-point drop in stock prices this week, that was the heart attack, wasn't it? After the House of Representatives failed to act on the plan?
It certainly was. does, yes. And you know, more less visible but more important is what's happening in the credit markets. It's not easy to kind of punch up on your TV screen or computer exactly how these markets are seized up. But overnight lending rates among ostensibly healthy banks of 5% and 6% is off the charts, given how low the official rates are. So that is also what's a heart attack in motion. And I will say, you know, markets have a tendency of inflicting as much pain as necessary to get what they want. And you know, you could see it as a heart attack, or you could see it as a tantrum.
Yeah, Leonard, if you owned 100 shares of American Widget last week in your 401k, you still have them. And if that company earns profits over time, your stock will come back. The temporary fluctuations in the market represent what speculators are doing. It is the credit markets. And there we're getting actually some very troubling signals. The only company on the original Dow Jones industrial list that's still around is GE. GE just made a deal with Warren Buffett to pay him a 10% dividend on preferred shares. Now, it could have borrowed in the bond market at 15%, deducted the bonds, and paid the same amount of money. GE has bonds out there that it's been selling at well below 10%. If GE has to pay the functional equivalent of a 15% coupon rate, when a week ago it could have borrowed money at, 5 or 6%, Michael, somewhere in that range?
Maybe a bit higher than that, but yeah.
Oh, a little bit higher than that, maybe a little over 6%. That's telling you that if this gold-plated company has problems, that there's real problems out there in terms of the credit market now.
Now, Treasury Secretary Paulson has proposed creating a troubled assets relief program to deal with the current credit crisis. Is there hope that TARP, as it's being called, would be a kind of RTC2?
There is hope, certainly.
But it is fundamentally different than RTC, isn't it?
It's fundamentally different in how it's going to be executed, yes. For one thing, it does not contemplate at this point, shuttering and taking over institutions. You know, I would point out to another distinction, and obviously there were some very large SNLs that got in trouble back in the prior crisis, but for the most part, it was, you know, many, many smaller institutions that, as an industry, really, they got into trouble. This time, it's the very largest, the very most prominent, and the very most visible ones that that are in the middle of this. So it's not a matter of we would like to take over these institutions and run them and liquidate them. It's much more about trying to take a certain large percentage of the problem assets and kind of warehouse them in a government fund for a certain period of time, and then so hopefully down the road, if the markets return to normal, realize some value out of them.
When Secretary Paulson rolled out his first plan, people were stunned by how much discretionary power he had given himself. Has that been cut back at all in these new proposals? Is there going to be more oversight?
Well, there's some oversight, Leonard, but the original proposal just sort of shredded the Constitution. It imbued in one man unreviewable power. Neither Congress nor the courts could question what he did, treating Congress and the courts like an appendage to the to the executive. That quickly got shot down.
Wait, who wrote that? Dick Cheney wrote that, or Henry Paulson?
And now it was, I don't know who wrote it, but it was in Mr. Paulson's bill, and that actually was a good example of how poorly they sold this and how poorly they've prepared people for a problem that we know has been around by the simplest estimate, by the most liberal estimate here, since August of a year ago, and some of us were writing stories 5 and 6 years ago saying something like this is going to happen. The oversight, however, is pretty mild. There is no separate inspector general, although I suppose the Treasury inspector general has authority, but the oversight board has 5 members. They include the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the other primary proponent of this plan, and the secretary of the Treasury. And even though we're going to have a new secretary of the Treasury, when that'll become relevant, you don't oversee yourself.
The other day, the chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair, said she supports a temporary increase in the limit on insured banking deposits. And both Senator McCain and Senator Obama say they support an increase in FDIC insurance from $100,000 to $250,000. What do you think that move is intended to do? Will it help the markets?
Well, I think, you know, what it's intended to do is obviously it's a gesture to say that we are actually also doing something for the saver, not just for the health of these big impersonal greedy institutions.
So this is the Main Street as opposed to Wall Street SOP?
Yes, although it's interesting. I mean, there's not a tremendous number of, the median person out there who has to worry about the FDIC limit. I think it serves mostly as a reminder that even if your institution is perhaps unsound or wobbly, your money is safe. And so if it's a reminder, then it sort of calms the markets a little bit. People have pointed out that, it's essentially just sort of adjust for inflation from the last time it was increased. But Dave is absolutely right, though, that the unintended consequence the prior time was to make some of these institutions more reckless.
Mm-hmm. And could that happen again here?
Certainly possible here. I think that we're in a little bit of a different banking system here, in that there are more alternatives to to these savings accounts. Although unfortunately the money market is not looking as safe as it usually is. But it certainly could. I mean,
because
also the other thing that raises
risk
levels among institutions is they all pay effectively a uniform insurance premium to the FDIC. So in other words, there's no real incentive to run a safer institution if you're paying for the insurance at the same rate everybody else is.
But there are no added safeguards to this plan to raise the FDIC insurance that would prevent investors from taking excessive risk.
Not investors, the institutions themselves. And that's the thing that I believe is not in there.
The current bailout bill is expected to be in the billions, $700 billion, I guess, is what the accepted figure. What was the ultimate cost for the government of the savings and loan debacle?
$125 billion in the dollars of that time, which would be, what, about $200 billion today, Michael?
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds about right, yeah.
So do you think that the government handled its response to the savings and loan crisis pretty well at that time?
Pause.
That means
rising.
That you're not sure.
Well, the sun is still rising every morning.
We survived Warren Harding as president as well.
That's right. I mean, the question is, what did we learn from that, and why do we continue to have these problems? And fundamentally, we have them because we have a campaign finance structure in America where Wall Street and companies that depend on Wall Street for their financing produce the money that really determines who gets elected to high office, particularly congressional districts, most of which are safe if you're a Dem or safe if you're a Republican, and weed out people running for president. And so the views that get to the top tend to be views that are compatible with these people's interests. Well, society is a lot more complex than that, and we need to have much more rounded government policies that look at everyone's interests.
And a lot of depositors and investors lost money in the S&L crisis, and they never recovered it, did they? Wouldn't the same be true here?
Many of them did not, and there are certainly people taking a lot of actions. I'm the chairman of the board of a little company with one of my sons, and we often have more than $100,000 in cash temporarily. We have the money today, and next Tuesday we have to meet payroll. And we have, for some time, broken our money up into different bank accounts, which is a real pain to go do just because of concern about that $100,000 limit.
Conspiracy theorists noted that Neil Bush made a lot of money as a result of the S&L crisis. I have no idea whether that was just that whether he was just in the right place or something else was going on there.
Don't know enough about it to comment.
Uh-huh. Well, we will see how this thing proceeds. I guess we'll know whether the plan was a success or a failure in, what, 10, 15 years from now?
Oh, I think a lot sooner than that. I think we'll have a very good idea soon of whether the credit markets start to return to normal, and then there are a couple things you're likely to see. First of all, you're likely to see inflation. What we're doing is inherently inflationary, although the decline in the value of assets is deflationary. But governments typically get out of these big debt problems by inflating the currency. And then we'll see if there's some adjustment made to focus more on the problems of homeowners and small landlords, who are being completely cut out of the discussion here. There are a number of small landlords around the country who got lured into these toxic mortgages. And if they get shut out, then you're going to have a lot of renters who will end up being evicted when they had nothing to do with this.
And then the next president, whichever one wins, will be blamed for this increase in inflation and all of these people losing their homes?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not going to vote for anybody. I don't want to cause anybody any more trouble than necessary. I want to thank you both so much for being with us today to talk about the comparisons of the SNL crisis with what's happening today. David K. Johnson and Michael Santoli, Michael Santoli, associate editor of Barron's Magazine. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leonard.